The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Welcome back to the show, my friends, and welcome to 2021. I hope you all had a wonderful holiday season and were able to find some time for a break, perhaps spending time with family or friends, and being safe and absolutely getting some well-deserved rest. I know I did. Now that we're in a whole new year, why don't you say we try this over again, and let's hope that this year turns out a lot better than last year. So, to kick off 2021, I'm going to take you through the case of Lavinia Fisher, sometimes considered one of America's first serial killers and the first female serial killer. Although the veracity of her crimes have been questioned by historians and the tales of her crimes have most likely been greatly exaggerated, Lavinia and her husband slash accomplice John were actually part of a gang, believe it or not. She and John ran a hotel called the 6 Mile Wayfarer House outside of Charleston, South Carolina. A handful of male boarders went missing over a period of a few years, which brought suspicion on the Fishers, and they also allegedly committed highway robbery. Literally, it's not just a saying. While the details surrounding the missing men are hazy and full of holes, leading some to believe that she in fact never actually killed anyone, the couple was still arrested and convicted of assault with the intent to murder and were executed by hanging on February 18, 1820 for highway robbery. That's right, they were arrested for one charge, but executed for another. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Because the crimes committed by John and Lavinia Fisher are centuries old, it's no surprise that the details surrounding their lives are pretty scarce, and much of their story seems to be driven more by legend than fact. But I'm going to do my best to paint as full a picture as possible for you all. So to start, John was born to James and Esther Fisher in 1791 and was the youngest of the Fishers' four children. Lavinia was born 2 years later in 1793. They eventually met and married, spending most of their lives in Charleston, South Carolina. In the early 1800s, they ran a hotel slash boarding house called the 6 Mile Wayfarer House, simply named because it was located 6 miles outside of Charleston. The house apparently also, quote, served as a hideout for a number of outlaws, end quote. And like I said in the intro, as it turns out, John and Lavinia weren't the sweet married couple that maybe those who didn't know any better thought they were. The Fishers were popular among the locals, which helped them to avoid any suspicions with regard to their possible nefarious hobbies. They were part of a gang of highwaymen called the 6 Mile Gang, and most likely operated this house as a way to not only earn money, but also to pick out potential victims to rob. There are several legends surrounding the couple in terms of their alleged murders. If a man stopped at the hotel for the night, Lavinia would extend an invitation to dinner, engage in some polite conversation with her guests. She would ask what they did for a living, often trying to gauge their wealth. After dinner, she would offer the gentleman a cup of tea, probably laced with something like oleander, which could make those who ingested it feel nauseated and force them to just want to go to bed because they weren't feeling well. So the man would drink the tea and go to sleep, and then John would allegedly sneak into the room and stab the man to guarantee they were dead. Another likely unfactual story is that the poison tea would, quote, only put the men to sleep for a few hours. Then, when they were almost asleep, Lavinia would pull a lever and the bed would collapse and drop the victim into a pit. Some believe that there were spikes waiting at the bottom of the pit, end quote. And as horrifying as each of these stories are, they are most likely not true. There is no evidence to substantiate either, and they're probably just the result of an increasingly exaggerated tale of their potential malevolence due to the rumor that reports of many missing men were made to the local sheriff's office, and they were never able to find out what actually happened to these men. The legend states that as more and more reports came in about men who had traveled to Charleston but basically fell off the face of the earth, the Wayfarer House came under suspicion as it was reported to be the last place anyone could recall seeing them. But of course, with no evidence that John and Lavinia were involved, plus the fact that so many people held the Fishers in high regard, these complaints were dismissed and the investigation stalled. But still, claims of theft and violence continued to pour in from traders with large amounts of cash leaving Charleston, or people heading into town to sell their goods who were often finding themselves at the mercy of thieves who would attack them on the road waiting to intercept them and rob them. The gang that John and Lavinia were part of was called the 6 Mile Gang, along with fellow members William Hayward, who was also, I found in some of my sources, possibly a co-owner of the hotel, along with John and Lavinia. There was also Joseph Roberts and James McElroy. Now, being the only woman in the group, Lavinia had to rely on her good looks and charm to gain the trust of their intended victims. Her reputation as a hospitable host also made the hotel a very popular stop for travelers. Like I said, many historians are not convinced that the Fishers ever killed anyone, but that doesn't mean that they were necessarily innocent, wrongfully blamed members of society. As reports of robberies on the roads leading in and out of town began to deeply concern local residents, they didn't like what was going on, a group of men decided to travel to Charleston in February 1819 and put a stop to the attacks once and for all. The details of their quote-unquote visit are unknown. There are a few rumors, possible stories, but the story kind of goes, this group of vigilantes left Charleston. They felt confident that they had restored order to the area, and they made the decision to leave one man behind, almost as a guard, someone to keep tabs on any criminal activity after their departure. And that man was David Ross. With Ross's lingering presence taken as a threat, he was actually attacked the day after his group left on February 18th. Two men jumped him and took him to face a group of highwaymen that he had come to stop, actually, and among that group were supposedly John and Lavinia Fisher. Ross saw Lavinia's face, assuming that he could maybe lean on her feminine sensibilities and ask her for help, but instead, Lavinia looked at him and her eyes narrowed, almost flickering with delight as she grabbed Ross by the neck and started choking him. The men encouraged her on as she dragged Ross over to the window, smashing his head into it, and the gang continued to beat Ross, but he somehow managed to escape and alert authorities to what had happened. There was also another rumored allegation against the Fishers during this time, but like I said, a lot of this is probably hearsay, not really based in fact, and just kind of perpetrates the infamy of this couple. A traveler by the name of John Peoples was passing through and stopped at the hotel. He inquired about lodging, but Lavinia told him that they were full. But she also offered for him to come in and rest for a while. She would get him a cup of tea, they could talk. Peoples wasn't a fan of tea, but he still accepted the offer because he didn't want to seem ungrateful. So he and Lavinia talked for a while, reports say a couple hours maybe, but the conversation seemed to lean towards more of an interrogation than what Peoples would describe as a natural exchange. And this made him very uncomfortable. It's also possible that the tea was poisoned, but since he didn't drink tea, he sneakily poured it out when Lavinia wasn't looking, so she's sitting there expecting him to maybe pass out or start to feel ill, and time passes and nothing happens. So she tells him that they miraculously just had a room become available, which he accepted, but with a little bit of hesitation. The questions that she had asked him made him very concerned. Was he about to be attacked and robbed after he fell asleep? Was he in danger? Not really sure, but he decided to sleep in a chair by the door, believing that this would give him a better chance to awaken faster and defend himself if someone were to enter the room. And because it's a wooden chair, it's not the most comfortable sleeping position, so Peoples often woke up throughout the night, checking the room to make sure he was safe, and at one point during the night, a loud crash startled him awake and he looked over at the bed. It had supposedly collapsed, and that was enough for him. He jumped out of the window, ran away from the Fishers in the middle of the night, and reported what had happened. Alright friends, I'm going to take a short break, so hang on just a second, I'll be right back. And welcome back, friends. So this incident, coupled with the assault on David Ross, led John and Lavinia Fisher to be the ones identified as the responsible party. On February 22, 1819, authorities traveled to Charleston to the hotel, and after a short search and a standoff between police and the Fishers, along with two other members of the gang, John surrendered to avoid his wife being shot. Colonel Nathaniel Green arrested the couple as well as their partners, and John also rolled over and gave up the names of all the other members of the gang during questioning in another bid to protect Lavinia from being punished. However, David Ross's account of his attack included the part where Lavinia supposedly took over beating him, so she was held as an equally responsible party. Over the next month, the Fishers were held in prison, and eventually on May 10th, they were both, quote, indicted for assault with intent to murder and also common assault on David Ross, end quote. The trial began on May 27th. Both John and Lavinia entered a not guilty plea, but with the testimony given to the court by David Ross, the trial was extremely short and resulted in the couple being found guilty. John and Lavinia Fisher spent the next 8 months in jail waiting to be sentenced. The court ruled that they should remain locked up in the Old City Jail while some of their co-conspirators were released on bail, except for William Hayward, who was eventually sentenced to death by hanging. At one point, they decided they were going to try to escape, so John had made a hole in the wall under the window in their cell, and they used their bed linens and blankets to fashion a makeshift rope and lower themselves down. How no one noticed a hole big enough to fit a grown man is kind of beyond me, and clearly they weren't being checked on enough. On September 13, 1819, John and Lavinia made their escape attempt. John went first, and when Lavinia tried to follow, the blankets apparently ripped, and she would have been unable to land safely without injuring herself, so she told John to run. He didn't want to leave her behind, but she was adamant that he go, so he did. He was gone for 3 days until authorities caught up to him on September 16th and brought him back to the cell. And from then on, police kept a much closer eye on the couple in order to prevent another escape attempt. On January 17, 1820, they, quote, appeared before the Constitutional Court for sentencing and were condemned to be hanged on February 4, 1820, end quote. The Fishers had hoped that this hearing would have granted them a new trial, but all it did was somehow change the guilty charge from assault to highway robbery, for which they were not originally arrested. In the days leading up to their execution, John buried himself in religion. He sought counsel from Reverend Richard Furman, but it may have been maybe a ploy to convince the courts that he was a changed man and repentant and no longer a danger. He actually used this to plead with the court to withdraw the sentencing, but of course, the court didn't change their mind. Lavinia, however, took a different approach. Instead of trying to convince the court that she was contrite, she became increasingly bitter, arguing that the court shouldn't be allowed to execute a married woman and that it was against the law. This may have actually been a law, so the decision was made to execute John first and then Lavinia, so therefore she'd be a widow and not married. Problem solved. The day of their execution, the couple was granted a stay until February 18th. I'm not entirely sure why it was delayed, but it was. So when the 18th arrived, there was no more delays. Time was up. John walked calmly to the gallows. While it said that Lavinia, quote, had to be physically dragged to the platform where she beseeched the crowd to help her. According to one historian, she stamped in rage and swore with all the vehemence of her amazing vocabulary, calling down damnation on a governor who would let a woman swing. The crowd stood shocked into silence while she cut short one curse with another and ended with a volley of shrieks, end quote. As Lavinia stepped onto the platform, some reports have her wearing her wedding dress, which, if she did, she apparently had a flair for the dramatics, which I will admit I love, but the chances of it actually being her wedding dress are slim, and I'll explain that later. So it was more than likely just a simple white dress, and then rumor and exaggeration has allowed it to become a wedding dress. She also believed that the governor wouldn't allow a woman to be hanged anyway and expected a pardon to release her even as the noose was being tightened around her neck. And of course, no such pardon came as 29-year-old John and 28-year-old Lavinia steadied themselves on the platform. John again declared how sorry he was for what he had done, but Lavinia again had a different sentiment to share. As she gazed out to the people in the crowd, she allegedly screamed at them, quote, "If you have a message you want to send to hell, give it to me, I'll carry it," end quote. Some reports have her leaping off the platform to her death rather than allowing the hangman to decide her final moment. Others say she accepted her fate and calmed down and waited for the platform to fall out from underneath her and her husband, but either way, both John and Lavinia Fisher were executed in 1820 in Charleston, South Carolina, by hanging. Unfortunately, it seems like a lot of the horror surrounding the story of John and Lavinia Fisher is more due to legend and rumors and exaggerations. It's highly unlikely that Lavinia Fisher was actually a serial killer, but the story is still interesting because, if anything, she seems kind of feisty and maybe targeted because she didn't seem to embrace the traditional role of a woman during that time period. Additionally, the customized bed that dropped sleeping guests onto a spiked floor, which is horrific to think about, John sneaking into the room where the guests are passed out and then stabbing them to ensure they're dead, stories of hundreds of bones from previous victims being scattered across the land or buried under the house. These are all legends. These are all rumors. They're falsities that have been stirred up over the years. One of my sources likened the rumors to basically a 200-year-old game of telephone, which is a pretty good visual, I think, of how facts can get twisted and distorted, especially in cases like this, especially when there's little documented evidence as to what actually happened. There were apparently some remains found on the hotel's property, but there's no solid evidence to actually link John and Lavinia to those people and their death, because this was the 1800s. CSI didn't exist, so there would basically have to be someone who saw the person murdered, or the murderer would have to be found standing over the body in order to be convicted by a court. There is another version of the story that seems to indicate that maybe John and Lavinia were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, because they were allegedly providing housing for members of the Six Mile Gang, and maybe that's where it stopped. Maybe they were just providing housing and maybe got a cut of the robbing. I have no idea. But there are rumors of a brawl that broke out in the Wayfarers' house, which caused John, Lavinia, and several other guests to flee, which included some members of the gang. This brawl sounds like it could have been possibly the encounter between the group of men sent to end the highway robberies and the members of the gang itself, but it was violent and resulted in at least 12 people being arrested, including the Fishers, but out of those 12, only John, Lavinia, and William Hayward were found guilty. So how does that make any sense if they weren't directly involved in the fight? Because of that, there's also a rumor that's saying the Fishers maybe were targeted for political reasons, that the government wanted the land their hotel sat on, and the fact that the hotel's owners were the only ones executed leads some to consider that they weren't actually guilty, but rather they were quote-unquote taken care of, so there would be no dispute in acquiring their land for the Charleston Naval Hospital. There is also speculation that the Six Mile House was burned to the ground after this brawl, which means that any story that has Lavinia going to the gallows in her wedding dress is false, because the dress would have been burned along with the house. Additionally, part of the touristy draw of the legend of John and Lavinia Fisher is that Lavinia's ghost supposedly haunts the Unitarian Cemetery, where some claim she was buried, but in reality, she and John were buried in a potter's field, which first had a military school built over it, and then that was replaced in 1964 with the Medical University of South Carolina. So, if you happen to go on a haunted tour in Charleston, and your tour guide tries to tell you that there have been sightings of Lavinia Fisher's ghost in the cemetery, you can call them out on it. Thank you all so much for listening and for your support and encouragement. I am so excited to begin a new year, new episodes, and I hope that you will continue to listen each week and enjoy them as much as I enjoy doing them for you. As always, please feel free to reach out to me on any of my social media accounts or email me at maskofsanitythepodcast@gmail.com. If you're looking for ways to help me support as many victim services as I can, don't forget I have a Patreon with bonus episodes. I have my merch store, which has lots of cool designs, so you could wear a t-shirt or a mask, stickers, whatever you want. I also have a Ko-fi account, which does one-time donations, so there are plenty of ways to support that way if you're so inclined. Otherwise, if you haven't left the show a 5-star rating and review, please do so. It's always so appreciated and helps the show find a bigger audience. This whole journey has been so amazing. I am so excited to start a new year with you. And I would love for you to also stick around after the show for the promo trailer for True Crime Dark Injustice. This show was previously called For the Victim and was rebranded a couple months ago under this new name. It's produced by fellow Oracle Network podcaster Kat Morris and will cover the same kind of content and stories as For the Victim, focusing on lesser known crimes. So make sure to subscribe wherever you listen and also leave the show a 5-star rating and review. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hello, listeners. For the Victim podcast is changing our look and our name, but the content of our stories will not change.
I'm hoping that by working to put monsters like you away, I might be able to stop the nightmares and start healing.
Keep listening, because our new show, True Crime Dark Injustice, will continue to dig deep into the darkest parts of lesser-known true crime stories.
You made a critical mistake. You underestimated the mind, power, and will of your victims. While we were mentally strong enough to endure your countless hours of abuse, strong enough to endure the pain of keeping your secret, we were ultimately strong enough to take you down. Not one by one, but by an army of survivors. We are Jane Doe's no more.
The objective remains the same, to explore whether justice was truly served and whether the crime could have been prevented. We are committed to sharing these dark and harrowing stories in remembrance for the victim.
Do you remember me screaming at the top of my lungs and you yelling and screaming at us that you had a gun and you would shoot us? You remember me flinging my body on top of my startled husband to protect him from you? Do you remember tying our hands and feet so tight with many of our own shoelaces? Our hands and feet were numb for many, many, many weeks afterwards.
You can find True Crime, Dark Injustice everywhere you get your podcasts. Stay tuned.